You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This psychological crime thriller takes us inside the mind of a unique female serial killer, a prostitute who murdered seven adult men, a case with which the author was intimately involved. The issues raised by this high-profile criminal case remain unresolved to this day. Women, even prostitutes, have the right to self-defense in theory, but in practice the story is more complicated. This book will challenge everything you ever thought about prostitutes, serial killers, and justice in America. Aileen Wuornos is a damaged soul, a genuine American outlaw, a symbol of women's rage, a symbol of what can happen to severely abused children, and of how our justice system fails women. Chesler's involvement with a serial killer has haunted her ever since. She speaks in Aileen Wuornos' voice, as well as in her own, and delivers an incisive, original and dramatic portrait of a cognitively impaired, traumatized, and alcoholic woman who endured so much pain in her short life. When she had had enough, the results were deadly. This is a poignant, sometimes humorous, never-before-told, behind-the-scenes tale. Wuornos' story is handled with great sensitivity, but also with realistic detachment by Chesler as she probes the telling moment, the telling phrase. Was Wuornos suffering from post-traumatic stress after a life lived on a killing field? Was she also born evil? So many prostitutes have been tortured, murdered by serial killers. How did Wuornos, once prey, become a predator? Requiem for a Female Serial Killer will also haunt you. It won't let you put it down. Take a walk on the wild side. The ghost of Aileen Wuornos beckons. The book that we're featuring this evening is Requiem for a Female Serial Killer with my special guest journalist and author, Philip Chesler. Welcome to the program and thank you so much for this interview, Phyllis Chesler.
It is my pleasure to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining me on this to talk about your Requiem for a Serial Killer. Now, you open in your book Florida 1990. In a report, two women are being sought, shooting deaths of 8 to 12 middle-aged men lured to their deaths in Florida highways. A suspect number one, a white female, 5'10", blonde hair. Suspect number two, white female, 5'4" to 5'6", heavy build and short brown hair. They are armed and dangerous and possibly the nation's first serial killers. And it was a warning put out to men traveling off Highway 175, I-75. All of these men were strangers, not husbands, not intimates. You, soon after Aileen is arrested, Lee Carol Wuornos called you a few months after she was arrested. Tell us about that conversation. What was said in that short amount of time?
Well, first, when I first heard the announcement, I thought it was a joke. It wasn't possible. And then when she was captured, I thought, well, okay. And what drew me in was the hope, the vision that we could present to a jury the nature of prostitution in America and globally, which is the most extreme form of violence towards women, and it's not understood that way. So when she called me for the first time, and there's a backstory to how I arranged that, I knew I would only have a few seconds to get her attention. So I said, Lee, I represent a feminist government in exile. We know that you've been captured, and we'd like to help. And she responded, far fucking out. You're the women's lib, right? I said, yes. And then she said, tell the women out there that I'm innocent. Tell them that men hate our guts. I was raped and I defended myself. And she referred to the known, I mean, Gerald Steno had been killing prostitutes, mainly black cocaine addict prostitutes, all over Florida, was never caught for a long time. She knew about this. The corpses littering the highways were those of women, not of men. So what she did ultimately was a first. As you said already, she was meant to be prey, and she became, the first time out, someone who killed in self-defense. I really believe that. Thereafter, something changed, and she became a predator. So that's how it began.
Now, give our audience your background at this time and position at this time when you are talking to Aileen on the telephone. What is your background in your feminist activist background? Tell us about that.
Well, since the late 1960s, I've been involved in all the issues as a scholar, as a professor, and as an activist in terms of violence against women. Rape, incest, woman battering, pornography, prostitution. And I don't think that we changed a lot of consciousness, but we failed also to command our point of our abolitionist point of view, either in the media or on campuses. So I saw her. I didn't even think, is she a serial killer? Do you really want to mix it up with a serial killer? I only saw her as someone who'd been raped all her life, paid to be raped eventually, who probably had organic brain syndrome and other cognitive and neurological impairments, hustled every day of her life from the time she was quite young, like maybe 9 or 10. And I go through all of the traumatizing and torturous experiences that she had. And she was the tougher for it and the more dissociated for it. So I saw in her the opportunity to put prostitution on trial, to put male violence and contempt for women who are prostitutes or who they view as if they are prostitutes on trial. I also wanted to have a jury hear that women should have the right to kill in self-defense, but mainly don't. The first time that Aileen killed in self-defense, what could she have done? Gone to the police? There was a warrant out for her arrest. She was already a criminal by definition because she was selling sex for money. The Johns don't get arrested. They are not seen as criminals. So there's a little movement in that area, but not much really. So what could she have done? She had to just go back to earning her daily bread, so to speak. So I didn't even contemplate, is she a serial killer? If so, what kind? And it took me years to profile the kind of very unique serial killer that she is.
When did the decision come to be able to try to defend her with this rape self-defense? How much information did you have before you endeavored to take upon this project?
Well, I had already written about three cases in America from the 1970s in which women, mainly women of color, had killed in self-defense because they were raped or in one instance to avoid being raped. And there's case law that I wanted the Florida public defenders to consider, because I thought it might apply. Now, of course, she didn't get a fair deal, a fair shake, not in her life and not at her first trial and not when she made her first confession, because the video of that confession, when her only goal was to rescue her lover who was the one who betrayed her by taking the stand against her. And the cops cannily set that up. and I write about what they did and what it led to. So the fact that Lee, that's what people call her, the fact that Lee kept referring to she killed in self-defense 16 times in that confession, the jury didn't get to hear that because somebody edited it out of the video that the jury was shown. So that's just one of many, many examples of too little justice for her. On the other hand, I can't say, well, the public defenders threw the case because she was a hard client. She cursed like a sailor. She cursed like all the men who were Johns in her life, none of whom she hated. She thought they were her friends or her boyfriends. Some of them gave her advice, carry a gun. You know, in effect, you're not working, honey. You're in a war. So she started carrying a gun, which did save her life that first time. And this is something that I talked to her about at length. She would never, ever reveal the details of each murder. So I had to imagine it through her eyes based on what I understood about her, what I had learned from talking to her and corresponding with her and reading every piece of paper, legal and otherwise, that I could find. And she was a very quick study because suddenly here she's hearing from a feminist who has other feminists backing her up, who want to put together a team, like a dream team for her. She starts talking like a feminist. I was kind of impressed and amazed. So I think that women who are prostituted pretty much know how to say what they think the customer wants to hear. And you never get to know what they're really thinking. So she was quite good at that. And I remember at a certain point, I asked her, could you please write down for me how many times you've been raped? And she did, and then she read it to me on the phone. Well, her definition of rape was not my definition. And okay. I've studied rape trauma syndrome, and anyone who's listening knows that some women, they get raped once and it changes, it crushes a bit of their soul for a while, if not forever, even if they continue on with their lives. So her definition was when a bunch of guys, probably on the young side, tie you down, tie you up, gang rape you, rob you, threaten to kill you, beat you up, but then you live. So she was giving me examples of this, and then she had another definition of being raped, which was if you sell the sex, which is like getting money for being raped, but the guy doesn't pay you. That's another definition of rape to her. And after sure. she got through, 10 or 15, I said, you can stop now because it's way off the charts, although it's totally typical of any prostitute's life. And she says, nah, I can keep going. It's okay. It doesn't bother me. I'm thinking, oh, my God, but it bothers me. You know, such yeah. extreme, profound violence. And she toughed it out and drank. You have to drink or take drugs and get dissociated in order to make your way through this war zone.
Let's talk about her background, because I know people have, like I said to you in the beginning, before the program, I've read all kinds of things about her horrendous upbringing, but there are things in this book that you chronicle that I don't think people are aware of, like that she had experienced death and seen a corpse. But let's go back to everything that you found out about her background and also her foray, I guess, into selling sex at a young age.
Very young.
And also the
rape. Well, her biological father hung himself in jail. He was known as a pedophile and a wife beater. Her biological mother, who I tracked down in Texas and who was afraid to visit her even on death row, afraid of her daughter, who had a bad, bad temper, no compassion possible. Unfortunately, her grandparents, who were both alcoholics, ran her biological mother out of town, and then they told Lee and her brother Keith that they were her real parents. Whether they performed a legal adoption or not, I'm not sure. I can check. And her grandfather was it's Finnish origin in Michigan, Troy and Rochester, Michigan, where it gets pretty cold in the winter. And she was probably difficult and rebellious, and she was hard of hearing and visually impaired. And the grandmother, who Lee claimed did really love her, never corrected these impairments. I'm not sure why not. She managed to get herself into different kinds of trouble, but her grandfather beat her savagely for minor infractions as well as for major infractions. And then she was very proud that she didn't take drugs, and she didn't consider the beer that she drank a drug. I do, and because she drank a lot of it. But, you know, back in the day, she tried psychedelics, she tried grass. She had to obtain them somehow when she was 8 or 9 or 10. So she started getting them by having sex with neighboring boys. And this was voluntary. She said this was voluntary. But then when she was about 13 going on 14, she was raped and impregnated, presumably by a friend or someone who represented himself as a friend of her grandfather. And can you imagine what her family felt? Here she's someone who doesn't clean up after herself, who has a bad temper, who's loud, doesn't pay attention in school, can't see, can't hear very well. At the trial, I think this was true as well. She's pregnant. So she goes to the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers in an era when it was seen as shameful, and there was no question ever about keeping your baby. You have to, sight unseen, whip baby is whisked away. And by the way, that's the kind of torture, and it's catastrophic and traumatic, just that male serial killers cannot go through. In many ways, or in some ways, she was like male serial killers, bullied and isolated, and she did set two fires with her brother. But then her parents threw her out, and she lived in an abandoned car in the snow. Now, this is unheard of, because where were the social workers? Where was the police department? Where were the other adult right. neighbors? Why was she not looked after or rescued or helped in some way? Of course, she wasn't. And I'm not saying she was an easy ride, but she was a child. She was a child. So after she was raped, impregnated, and forced to give up, or probably wanted to give up, a baby for adoption, that's when she told her aunt, sister Lori, that men hate us. They really hate us. I don't know where that sentence came from in her head. But at that point, she hit the road. And she was young and good-looking and blonde and Scandinavian and was hooking on the road. Now, who's on the road? Truckers. They could be big and rough. And good time guys, likewise. And she was by then at 15, 16, drinking a lot of beer and had a child sense of money. So, for example, her brother Keith died and left her $10,000. A regular kind of person would say, maybe I could make a down payment on a house or fund some education. No, she blew it in 3 months on a car, which was repossessed, and on beer, music, and food. So I only gradually began to comprehend that maybe, even though she was slick and smart and drew beautiful drawings, that she may have had a low IQ as well, not a high one. And in many ways, she was thinking the way a child thinks. If you have enough money from the sex for a motel room for a couple of nights and for beer and food, you're okay. So the ability to plan ahead was non-existent, and unlike many high-profile male serial killers, she just left clues everywhere. She wasn't strategic in her killings. So here you have a child in America, a child of Michigan, who was just allowed to disappear and make her own little way in this wide, wide world. And in Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, I do have some of her descriptions, which are heart-rending, of what it means when guys get rough with you, exactly what it means. I'm not going to read them on the air, but, you know, this was her life, and she toughed it out. And when she was in jail in Citrus County, it was a male jail, and everybody was, like, taunting her, the male prisoners. And she started telling me about it, and I said, oh, my God, how can you bear it? And she goes, I'm tough. I can take it. It doesn't bother me. Let him talk. You know, so she was from another world, not my world. I'm privileged to lead a life of ideas and an activist life. She didn't have that chance. And in fact, it was funny because here I came and other feminists with me who were revolutionary in our vision, and we wanted to overturn this bad stuff. She just wanted a piece of the pie. She just wanted, you know, fair and square, her meals and her money for her work. Sure. Different. And she was a petit bourgeois capitalist and did not understand, could not believe why anyone, beginning with myself and others like me, would do something for no money. She didn't get it. So I was a fool also, not just she.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, Phyllis, we were talking about just her background. She gets married when she's 20 years old. Tell us about this very brief marriage.
She married Louis Fell, who she beat. She beat him, and he took out an order of protection against her. And she was very proud that he had a lot of money, but she wasn't going to stay with him, even for the money. She had a very interesting relationship to money, because on the one hand, she professed, I don't care about it, it's not important to me. On the other hand, once she was caught and she became notorious or famous, or as she put it, I've made history, then she was really obsessed with money. And I understand that many male serial killers are likewise. So she had two very different kinds of relationships to money.
Now, tell us about this relationship that really is a more than a contributing factor to these murders, but just the high point of Eileen's life. And tell us where they met, and then how this relationship, what was the dynamics of this relationship right from the start, and what did Eileen try to do for her new love, Tyra? Tyria.
Well, I wish I truly understood it. I also tracked Tyria down and interviewed her where she was living. I'm not going to say where. But both of them agree that Lee was not really a lesbian. I don't know what that means exactly, because she said she loved her and she confessed to save her. And she was her one and only, her only living person in her life. She didn't have family. She didn't have friends. So she had Tyria. So maybe they weren't sexual. Many prostitutes are not sexual. How can they be, given what they must do and what they must fake?
Right.
So perhaps they were bonded, joined at the hip but it wasn't necessarily or primarily sexual. So it was a matter of having someone there, a living being, a body in the cave, so to speak. So Tyria said she didn't like Lee hooking and that she would have worked two jobs, cleaning motels or doing minimal wage work to keep Lee off the road. Lee said no. Tyria wanted cigarettes and beer, and I had to keep giving her money, and I had to work to support her. Now, I could not decide where the truth lay between the two of them. So, and Lee, by the way, did not hate men, does not hate men, or at least that's what she said. On the one hand, men hate our guts. But on the other hand, hey, my best friends, you know, are these guys, you know, and they're like boyfriends. Or, and she, like a child, she would do some things that prostitutes do not do. She would cuddle. She would kiss. It's unheard of in the world of prostitution. So, again, signaling to me that there was a primitive child trapped in this grown-up body. And she had many boyfriends before the first lesbian love affair she had before Tyria. Many boyfriends. And she could not understand why they always screwed her and hit her and left her. So I tried to see a lot of it through her eyes because she really didn't understand why she kept getting in trouble. Genuinely didn't get it because she saw herself as trying hard and being forced to fail. Nobody gave me a break ever was her line. So she had a complicated relationship, as most prostitutes do, to sexuality. It gets wrecked for them. Wrecked.
Now, how did she conduct herself as this prostitute? It was she thought it was quite a novel approach to doing it. Inconspicuous, she said. She described it as. How did she approach prostitution, and who did she target?
She was very clever. Her disguise was to pass for normal. She was far from normal, but she wore cut-off shorts or jeans and a sweatshirt, very plain, no makeup, in no way tarted up. And she was clean, too, because many studies of prostitutes in general, and definitely in Florida, you know, they have open running sores. They have diseases that men have given to them. They have fevers. It doesn't stop the Johns, which is something I do not understand. And they are also dressed up to look like hookers. Not Lee. She was just dressed like an ordinary housewife. And her line was, oh, my car broke down and I have to pick up my kids. Can you give me a lift? Pretty clever. So, and she also, imagine, she had no car. And I think the main reason was not only that they could not afford a car, but she could not get a license, and there was a warrant out for her arrest, and she had already done time in jail for something that really she would say was not her fault. It happened to her. So she's walking, like biblically, along the highways in the blazing sun, or sometimes taking the Votran bus line. So she's like a creature from way back in the past, and everyone else is speeding by in cars. I would imagine that alone could cause a permanent resentment and a burn on a low boil that got hotter. So that was her MO, and it was simple and it was smart.
You talk about the treatment, and we were already talking about this, the treatment of prostitutes in general. I'm sure that people don't know, and this is what some of the promise of this book is to fill people in on the reality of what happens. Because many people still, I've heard it myself, they blame the prostitute for luring the men instead of men looking for women. But just the treatment of prostitutes and also Eileen's treatment in the past, before we talk about Richard Mallory or any of the subsequent other victims?
Well, you know, Warnos herself has a very good line, and it's the opening page of Requiem. She said, "If men would keep their money in their pockets and their penises in their pants, there would be no prostitution." And this is true. It is demand that drives it, not supply. And prostitutes, with a very rare half of 1% exception, are not making a free choice. It's a forced choice in order to eat. And the majority of prostitutes in the world, and certainly in the United States, are coming from highly dysfunctional, impoverished backgrounds. They're very often women of color, but not only. And they are raped, beaten, prostituted at home, like this woman who's about to be federally executed, Lisa Montgomery. Her mother prostituted her to a series of men at home from childhood on, and or from early teenage years on. So very typically, prostitutes are runaways hoping to get this awful stuff behind them. But of course, they're then latched onto by pimps, and they have to eat. They're homeless. Homelessness is a big problem. They don't have their children. They're 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. And the Johns want young children. They're pedophiles psychologically. Even when a woman is over 18, she has to pretend to look younger or say she's younger to be more marketable. So most prostitutes are not there because it's there, because they had a choice between becoming the president of a large corporation, the president of a university, or being a street hooker or an escort service hooker, or chained to the brothel wall traffic. And by the way, trafficking is the same as prostitution. It's someone being trafficked for the purpose of prostitution. And this is a huge global industry. It's bigger than guns, and it's bigger than drugs. And it's female and sometimes male, children male, sexual slavery. This is the biggest slave trade that we have, but it's simply not seen that way, which is unbelievable. And the prosecutor, John Tanner, who prosecuted Lee and who himself had been Ted Bundy's spiritual advisor, he has gone on record. He's written some articles in Florida newspapers describing prostitutes as vile, as evil, as causing healthy, wonderful family men, not only causing them to go astray, but giving them diseases when it's quite the other way around. So you're right. The general view of prostitution is she loves it. It's going to end well for her, a la the film Pretty Woman. She's bringing men down. Not that men are demanding it, but she's demanding of them their money. Why? Because women are not equal economically anywhere in the world. And yes, we have fabulous exceptions, but that's the rule. So something like war zones, genocidal war zones, poverty, homelessness, parents sell their girls. Pimps trick them by saying, come to America or to wherever, and you'll have a wonderful job, and you'll meet a great man, and he'll marry you, and everything will be terrific. And they fall for this from Eastern Europe, from Russia, from Ukraine, from Thailand, and then no exit from hell. And they are gang raped to season them and break their spirits. And then they're addicted to drugs, which they cannot do without. And then most of the money that they earn goes to the pimp and the brothel keeper and the landlord, etc. So you don't get rich from this so-called profession, which again, I repeat, it's not work like sex work. And here a group of us, a large number of us, part company with the feminists who believe that women have the right to sell anything, babies from their womb, any of their orifice for someone else's sexual pleasure, for money. I see it as slavery and as a forced choice and as extremely violent, as a war zone, a killing field, and not as like, you don't see the daughters often of very, very wealthy, civilized families choosing to be prostitutes. Yeah, some do, but that's not who's out there.
Yeah. This is as an opportunity to stop for the messages from our sponsor, which is Ritual. To really know what's in your multivitamin, my wife Lisa, about 8 months ago, decided to take a look at ritual.com to read about their unique approach to creating a woman's multivitamin. She was especially interested in their focus on absorbability of the vitamins and nutrients contained, and it's made Lisa a believer in Ritual. And she says she continues to feel the difference that Ritual makes every day. You'll always know where your nutrients come from thanks to Ritual's one-of-a-kind visible supply chain. Ritual is designed with different life stages in mind. Now available for women, men, and teens, Ritual multivitamins, including their best-selling prenatal, are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping, always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. You deserve to know what's in your multivitamin. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. Now, Phyllis, we were getting a little off track because what people have always looked at, and of course that's why she was convicted, and is that we have to get to the reality. The idea that people will accept the idea that a prostitute has shot 7 or more men in self-defense is beyond an uphill climb, despite the cases that you cite and you bring to the defense team. Let's talk about Richard Mallory and talk about where Eileen and Tyra were in their relationship when Richard Mallory came in into their lives.
Richard Mallory was a whoremonger and a pornography addict who, amazingly for a white man, did many years in jail for attempting to rape probably the wrong man's wife. And this is while he was married and happily married. He just couldn't get these visions out of his head. So he was not an upstanding guy. And the jury never got to hear about his lifestyle and his past imprisonment for sex addiction because, quote, the dead man is never on trial. So Mallory had just been partying with two other prostitutes who were, one of whom was picked up for his murder, but was ultimately let go because they were like Warnos because they too were prostitutes. And so they were made for his murder. Now, I believe Lee's very credible description of that night, which would have been in 1989, the end of November or the very beginning of December, even though she herself recanted this, I didn't believe the recantation. And I've been trained as a clinical psychologist, and I was a professor of psychology, etc. So, you know, I had in my bones, I believed her. The first trial, I found her moving and credible. She was the only defense witness for herself. Nobody else was called. And, I mean, none of our pro bono potential dream team were called. And he picked her up And by and by, they decided that, yeah, they'd have sex. And Lee gave him her prices. And he, before he tied her up and began to brutally torment her and do terrible things to her, he said, well, he doesn't really have the money. So that's already, he's going to rape me. He's going to rape me without paying me. That's way out of line to her. And she told him that. But he tied her up. He tied her to the steering wheel. And he had his terrible way with her. And when Lee was very rigid cognitively, and I give some examples of this in the book. Like, she would get on the bus and she'd say, you have to stop right here, where the bus driver always stopped. But no, the bus driver had a new mandate and he couldn't, and she went crazy because it had to be just on the line. So imagine if a guy, a John, wanted something that was way out of line to her or took it without her consent. Now, she would get pretty enraged. I mean, but really very enraged, so not normally enraged. So Mallory was in that category, and she finally, most miraculously, decided to save her own life because she figured he was not only going to kill her, but she said he's going to dissect me or some weird stuff. So she managed in a split second to get to her shopping bag in which she kept her gun. And she started shooting, and he didn't stop coming at her, and she kept shooting. Unlike a male serial killer, she covered his body up so that it wouldn't be pecked at by birds, and she didn't want to run over him. So she then drove his car, took whatever trophies or money he had in the car, lied to Tyria and said, well, you know, it's a friend of mine. You lent me the car, you know. We have to keep it out of sight. His wife will get jealous, whatever story she made up. And for a while, she didn't go right back to work. She was spooked. What happened spooked her. And as I said before, she couldn't go to the police. So she just drank a whole lot and continued on with life as she knew it to be. So Mallory was a really bad guy. And as in his treatment of women, and he had an ex-girlfriend, Jackie Davis, who was willing to testify to this. But of course, quote, the dead man is not on trial. So in so many different ways, the trial was not just or fair. And when you compare it to the trials of male serial killers, oh, there's no comparison, because they who kill mainly prostitutes, between 17 to 100 women, they will get life sentences, not necessarily execution, legal execution. And it takes the juries a while to make these decisions, like in Ted Bundy's case, also in Florida. But in Warnos's case, they decided very quickly, guilty unanimously in 1 hour and a half, and death sentence in another hour and a half, you know. So being perceived after the defense asked for a change of venue, they were not granted that. Ted Bundy was granted a change of venue to Miami from where he was first on trial. And everyone had been reading all about everything that she had done. And the depiction, I was told by feminists in Florida who worked with rape victims and battered women, you know, they're going to fry her for every woman that joined the National Organization of Women in Florida. She's going to pay the price because she's not just a prostitute. She's a lesbian prostitute. This is unheard of in this area, in these areas, these counties of Florida, which are not cosmopolitan Miami. Everybody's gay. Everything is happy. Everything goes. These are much more traditional areas. And I'm not judging them. That doesn't mean it's bad at all. It's just that it would view someone like her as a swamp creature from hell. And she's the real Thelma and Louise before the movie opened. She was there doing this before all the films that have since been cheered on with women assassins, battered wives who kill finally, There's a huge number of films that have now made it into the common culture, and she preceded most of them, which is kind of interesting.
Wow, preceding Hollywood in that fantasy world. But let's talk about Tyria, because really it's not fair to compare, I mean, except in a couple ways with Bundy, the trial. Bundy didn't have a Tyria Moore in the case.
Bundy, are you kidding? He had so many fans, and he married somebody who bore his child.
No, that's not what I mean. That's not what I mean.
What I mean is that
you have this incredible thing to overcome in terms of a rape defense, where even if it were proven to Richard Mallory, where it was self-defense in that case, that it was based on her confession. Now, what I'm saying is that this case is completely complicated by having Tyria in there, and then the approach by police, and then, of course, the phone calls and the confession, and the reason for the confession that Lee says and admits that was the reason for her confession. So what I'm saying is it's much different when you have the pressure on Tyria after she is told, and we didn't mention this, she is told by Lee that she has killed Richard Mallory.
Yes.
So let's talk about the relationship with Tyria and Lee after Richard Mallory, and then what happens in terms of behavior and conduct from Lee before we find out where the police finally catch up with these people based on composite drawings, and then that pressure on Tyria changes everything, doesn't it?
I think that Tyria didn't believe her. She thought she was the biggest liar and a bullshit artist par excellence. That's what Tyria told me. But eventually, she began to think it might be true, because Lee would come back to their motel room or their lodging, and she'd have another car, and she'd have a wad of cash, and she'd have a ring, maybe, a big size male ring. So I think over time, Tyria actually got scared. She wasn't right away scared, but she eventually got scared. And she went back to her family. She had a very large family. And Lee was totally broken up about this. And then the cops found Tyria and basically threatened her with arrest, conspiracy. She knew about it, and she didn't come forward. She's going to be tried for murder. And to get out of it, she had to start calling Lee, which she did. And they taped the calls. There was a wiretap from the jail. Lee kept saying, wait a minute, is this being taped? Are you really in trouble? And Tyria, reading her lines that the police gave her, said, oh, baby, you know, they're coming after me. They're coming after my family. I didn't do anything. This is not right. And eventually, Lee said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. So I call that chapter A Fool for Love. I mean, she confessed for love.
Right.
And Tyria not only helped entrap her to save her own skin, but, I mean, Tyria was seen she was seen driving wildly in one of the cars, and then they had an accident. She was witnessed, so she was culpable, and she was legitimately frightened and was willing to turn on Lee to get the heat off her. And she did not commit the murders, presumably, anyway. So what made Lee crazy was not Tyria's betrayal. What made her crazy was that the cops allegedly were cutting deals for a movie before they captured her.
Yeah.
And Tyria was in on it. So Lee's presiding obsession thereafter was the crooked cops. Sometimes she'd say what you wrote, this law review article, whatever I wrote about her case. It was very good, but you got to get the cops, you know. And what does that mean? That means the authority figures, the police officers, who in her past would have said, listen, I'm a cop, and you're going to give me sex, or I'm going to arrest you, and I'm not going to pay you, right? So she saw the cops in general and authority figures in general as corrupt and wanted to get them. And this was one of her main obsessions after she was captured. So Tyria, she got scared, and the cops had her, and the cops used her, and it worked.
Let's talk about this dream team and what you were attempting to do, and how you were trying to do that with these expert witnesses. But also that, let's talk about that, that what you attempted to do in the team that you assembled to be able to do that.
What our hope was that if a jury could understand how violent prostitution is, and how if they could understand what one rape could do to a woman, imagine being raped every day 250,000 times in your life or more, you could jump out of your mind. You could not know anymore where you are. You could decide finally to fight back. All of these are possible, but a jury uneducated would never get that, ever.
That's right.
And they didn't. So was Lee already so drunk she didn't know what she was doing? Well, to some extent, yeah, you could say that. Was she so permanently traumatized and angry and super vigilant? I mean, Tyria said that Lee would never let anyone get anything over on her. And that was a very important sentence for me, because when I profiled her, the kind of serial killer she is, she, unlike male serial killers, didn't go for vulnerable, younger, smaller people like girls and women. No, no. She punched up. It's unheard of.
Yeah.
She punched up. And that means she went for men who were taller and heavier and, to some extent, older, but not always, a lot older than she was. And she took them down. This is unheard of. So, so she was always angry and always arguing, and she picked fights with everyone. Tyria said it was too embarrassing to be in public with her. So when they went out to a bar together, Tyria was totally butch silent, said nothing, talked to no one, and Lee would often embarrass them. So what does this tell us about Lee Warnos? Tells us that she's got a borderline personality, which is the diagnosis for an incest victim. It tells us that she's got a not necessarily a sociopathic personality, but a borderline personality and a social personality disorder. She didn't know the rules at all of straight life.
Right.
Nothing. She couldn't conduct herself civilly. She didn't know the rules. I mean, when she made her confession, and I watched it and I read it a number of times, it was a video. She thought these cops were her Johns, like her friends. They offered her coffee. They offered her cigarettes. And she was just now beginning to detox from alcohol, lifetime's worth. And she was so soft-spoken and husky-voiced. And she really was acting. And she thought these guys were going to help her. She didn't know why she would need a lawyer. She goes, I'm going to tell you the truth. Yeah. What do I need a lawyer for? And they did not provide one until very late in that confession. So let me tell you, maybe I shouldn't say all of it, but there are a lot of women who are as abused as Eileen Warnos was. They don't become serial killers.
Right.
They may go down softly and slowly or fast, but they don't kill anyone. She did. And there's many women who are serial killers. She's not the first one. She's a unique one, but not the first. And they're known as black widows. I'm sure you know this. And they will kill husband after husband, or aging patient after aging patient, for insurance policy money or real property. And they will also kill girls who they lure into prostitution if they try to run away, sometimes if they don't. So women kill. It's not as if Lee was the first ever, but unlike male serial killers, she didn't do this for sexual reasons.
And she didn't pick on men because she wanted to mutilate them and pose them in obscene positions. She's the one that covered their bodies and didn't want to run over them by accident. So she may have been really angry at men in the way that male serial killers are permanently angry at women who they think are prostitutes, and they hate being dependent on women and want to triumph over female sexuality and birth-giving capacities. But she didn't organize her kills, and I had a theory of what may have happened after the first one with Richard Mallory. So what she did was unique. You don't have women going around, or prostitutes. Some may have killed a pimp or a John. There are some historical examples I give, but it's very rare. And it's not, as you pointed out, seven. And the men who Lee killed, three were Johns. The others may not have been. The others may have committed a cardinal error of she needed their money. She needed to eat. She had to pay the rent, right? But they didn't want sex with her. They didn't want to give her their money. That could have been her own personal demented affirmative action program.
Yeah.
Right? So that, but some of them were Johns because their bodies were naked or naked from the waist down. Or in Mallory's case, he wouldn't take off his clothes, but his belt and his pants were twisted to the side. So, and she didn't do this. So she's a unique serial killer.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for just for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about the trial, and she never got a break her whole life, and she never got a break at trial, and she never got a break with the prosecutor. You talked about his fervent prosecution. Trish, like you said, never the defense attorney never called any of your expert witnesses whatsoever in this
True.
Trial.
But that may not mean that she threw the case. It
No.
may mean that Lee was just too difficult a client. It may mean that Trish couldn't see a way through. She couldn't think out of the box. I mean, she is one of the boys who is used to representing men who rape and men who kill, women mainly. And here was a woman. How was she going to handle this? If she won, what would her position be? And I'm just guessing this. This may not be true. What would her position be in among the old boys network that she's part of? She got off the DICOR? Where's the win in that? And also, although I think that Lee was a credible and sympathetic witness on her own behalf, she,
right.
as I said, doesn't stop cursing. And in my opinion, by the time they executed her, she was legally insane. I said to her, you know, long before this, you could do an insanity defense. And she was very insulted. And she said, never, I won't, you know. I said, I think you qualify. But she didn't want that. And there was she didn't want people prying into her mind or finding fault with her mind. It was interesting. And do I think that it would have worked? Not sure. I'm sure Trish thought of this also and Lee refused to do it. Do I think that any state mental asylum like Chattahoochee in Florida would ever have let her out? No, I don't think so. And they
right.
would have drugged her up, but good. However, to be then on death row in isolation for so many years, it made her crazy. It makes a lot of, I mean, she both found God, she found Christ, and she went crazy. They were poisoning her food. There were sonic rays coming into her head. The lawyers
right.
who good meaning folk got for her, they were against her. They were part of the CIA or the FBI or outer space. And I thought, you know, We're not supposed to execute the insane. Am I wrong?
I was going to ask this question. This is, reading this book has given me this question. You
yes.
see the, again, she's a public defender, Trish, and she can't afford but one expert witness for the 7 trials that Eileen will be, Lee, that will be going, we're undergoing. And so how important was that 2 of those victims after Richard Mallory were law enforcement? And how important was it that the women were adamant that, and some of these guys had reputations, they were successful people, that they were adamant not to besmirch those people's reputations? How important was it first that law enforcement may be involved?
Important.
As victims?
I would say it was important. But remember, Lee, the outlaw, is the kind of outlaw that Americans become fans of, like Billy the Kid. Or there's an untold number of cults that follow killers, murderers of large
sure.
numbers of human beings. So she represented mythically someone who was meant to die unknown, but who became famous for killing. And Warnos has a lot of fans. I was very surprised to discover this. I was not a fan. I was a feminist abolitionist who wanted to have certain principles understood a lot better in our world. And ask me another question.
The idea that she, again, that I don't know if she's a folk hero, but I know that what I have seen, and I have not looked at this except just with posting about this program, that there is a lot of sympathy, that there are many people have gone out of their way to express that she had this horrible life and never had a chance right from the beginning. This is the kind of sentiment that's expressed about Lee Warnos.
Not in the courtroom. Not in the courtroom. And Trish, you're right. She had Trish did not handle any of the other cases because of how the first trial ended up. Lee decided with her unerring instinct to make always the wrong decision for herself, she allowed a really creepy lawyer to take her cases over, and she pled them out. She was not going to go on trial again because she saw that there would be no justice for her. Why waste time? And she thought that she could then die, that she'll just tell the state of Florida to kill her. I said, no, once they have you, it's up to them when, not you. But she didn't understand that. So Trish did have an Elizabeth McMahon, a doctor, a psychologist, and she had another witness who did refer to her limited and primitive childlike being and to her bad breaks in life. But it made no difference. It made no difference at all. That jury wasn't going to buy into any, you know, there can't be true justice without some mercy. She didn't get any mercy. And many prostitutes don't. When male serial killers kill them, we don't even learn their names. We just remember the names of their killers. So, and, you know, Trish also referred to her hard childhood and her hard life. It made no difference. Tana portrayed her successfully as a, quote, predatory prostitute whose, quote, appetite for lust and control had taken a lethal turn, as someone who, and this is really rich, who, quote, had been exercising control for years over men and who, quote, killed for power, for full and ultimate control. End of quote. I am quoting him directly. So this was why I wanted a jury to learn what prostitution is and what prostitution does. They didn't have that opportunity.
What about the effect? I always wondered about this as well. She has never done any serious crime, petty crime. She's been convicted of crimes that were just blunders. She works for limited funds. You know, her services don't fetch incredible amount of money.
No.
She doesn't own anything and has never lived anywhere and believes survival is, well, it is for her just day to day at a motel, which she's always scraping together funds. Has no car, like you say, resents that, has a bicycle. And
right.
She's doing all these things because she finally has a love in her life of someone that accepts her. They hang around with each other all the time. They hang out. How important was this at some point? These, again, I won't dispute Richard Mallory and her self-defense, but at some point, is it at least a factor that she wants to please and provide for her lover?
Well, that's what Lee said, and that's what she believed to be true. Tyria told me the opposite. And I think Lee wouldn't have given up hooking no matter what, because this was her forte. This was her game. This was her survival. This was what she was used to. These were fake relationships that may have been as close as she could come to a real relationship. And so I don't think she would have given up hooking, but I do think that Tyria may indeed have been telling me the truth, saying, look, I didn't want her to do it. I told her to stop. She wouldn't stop. I would have worked two jobs, but the two jobs that Tyria would have worked wouldn't have brought in as much money as Lee could bring in. Not that that was a huge sum, but Tyria, unskilled labor, you know, cleaning motel rooms, maybe working a cash register, I don't know. So I think both things are true, and they're opposite truths. What I wanted to say about cult followings, even though I do write about it because I was shocked to discover it, that Wikipedia, in the entry for her birthplace, Troy, Michigan, lists her as one of their notable people. Along with a Hall of Fame, check it out, Hall of Fame baseball player, a Tony Award winning actor, an NHL defenseman, so she's become a kind of folk hero, even though her life was sordid and tragic and beyond agonizing. She's now a folk hero, and people are buying on Etsy T-shirts with her image on it, and dirt where her ashes was scattered under a tree in Michigan. I mean, it's unbelievable. But
what is the attention? What is the focus of their admiration specifically?
They view her as an outlaw, a nobody who was meant to die anonymously, but who instead became a somebody, a woman who gave the royal finger to authority, who even took down cops. She was a biker-style rebel. And people are going to the last resort, the bar where she was arrested and where she hung out, and they have destination vacations at the motel, which is now renamed, that she once lived at. So that's another whole discussion that we could have, what is really going on there.
I'm sure the monster movie with Charlize Theron help that mythology along its way somewhat.
And Theron is a brilliant actress, and she impersonated her body language very, very well, but didn't get inside her. And of course, the character played by Christina Ricci is nothing like the real Tyria.
No, absolutely not. In this, I know it's hard to do and it's impossible to do, really, but you do attempt to sort of analyze this, because you say you immediately didn't think of her as a serial killer. You thought of it as a platform to be able to express these revolutionary ideas. But in the end, she was a serial killer. What's the end analysis for you, if there can be?
Well, like Anne Rule, I am haunted by this fact. Anne Rule, the great late Anne Rule, wrote about Ted Bundy. She was once his friend. She couldn't believe who he really turned out to be. So I, in my way, looked at her as a victim, wanted to use her for political purpose to help womankind and justice, and only gradually came to understand, she's a serial killer. And I was close to a serial killer. That's kind of interesting. I mean, that's terrifying. I'm new to true crime. Now I'm committed, but
This is the first such book I've ever written. So I managed to block out until it was utterly necessary for me to look at what she had done and try to explain why and how she had done this. So for me, it was an adventure in figuring it all out.
Before I let you go, tell us the fascinating story of how many years it took you, why it took 19 years. What? Tell us that agreement you had with yourself.
Well, I really wanted to make a difference in terms of her trial. And when I couldn't, and I wrote several op-ed pieces and then a couple of law review articles. I'm not a lawyer, but I did that. And I put it aside. We had a correspondence, and I published some of our letters in a chapter. I call them love letters. And I didn't want to – Trish was surrounded by media, and she didn't trust anyone. And she thought that I would also write something immediately and blow her case. And I said, I'll sign a legal document, you know, that I won't do anything, you know, for 20 years or until after everything is over. And whatever that may mean. And she didn't have me do it, but I don't think she ever trusted me. And I set it aside. I had other things to do. I wrote many, many other books during this time. And then literally as I was renovating my apartment, a box fell off the shelf. I opened it, and in it were about five chapters that I'd written long ago.
Wow.
And I couldn't put it down. It was wonderful. I said, oh, my God, and how timely and how burning these issues still are.
That's right.
And then I resurrected my entire Warnos archive, which meant they were on floppy disks. I had to convert them and then print them out. And then I read every scrap, the voir dire of the jury, every legal document I could lay my hands on, every other book written about her, magazine articles, and then the interviews. I interviewed everybody, and I have transcripts of the interviews. And then I realized, okay, now I'm going to do it. And as I was doing it from 2019 to 2020, you know, part of the time quarantined, I understood how unique she was as a serial killer. I didn't pay close attention before. I was writing round the clock intensely for a year. So that's why it took so long, because I really put it out of mind, out of sight. I let it go for a while.
Yeah. Well, it was well worth the wait. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. It's going to be released tomorrow. Is that not correct? And
Thursday,
could you tell us
almost.
About your
November 12th.
Can you tell us about your website as well?
Oh, yes. www.phyllis-chesler. It's out there, and I've got some very, very nice endorsements for this book up on my homepage, and hopefully there'll be some reviews, and I'll have that up soon enough, too.
Yes. Well, it's a brilliant offering. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. It's a brilliant, brilliant offering. Thank you so much, Phyllis Chesler. It's been absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
Good night.